You're from SNL! The chatter gets busy fast. They all know me now, even the one named Fred who hardly knew what a television was. They pat me hard on the back and laugh and order a pitcher of beer. I demand Wild Turkey 101. They didn't have much choice. I have them over a barrel. If there isn't a bottle of whiskey on my table, and soon, I am likely to take my famous self and walk it right out into the New York streets. So Charlie orders whiskey. Now a new game gets started. What's your name? I have no time for this. I am only interested in knowing what they think of me, so I just pointed the stitching on my SNL jacket. Oh, of course, says Charlie. It's Norm Macfarlane. Hey, Macfarlane, I knew it was you the whole time. I was a big fan. You did Weekend Update. Yeah, you were dry. You did dry comedy. I like dry comedy. I've always liked you, Macfarlane, but everybody I knew thought you sucked. They just didn't get you like I did. You were dry. Well, I didn't like him. Well, isn't that just like Charlie? The big one, the bully, to stop the conversation dead with his big, brawly opinion. Hey, come on, Charlie, it was you who invited him over. He was just sitting in the corner, minding his own business, muttering to himself. I remember him. I was in high school, and I watched the show because of Sandler and Farley. Then he'd come on talking about politics. He'd do some stupid joke, and then just stare at the audience with a big, dumb smile on his face. He was never funny. Well, I liked him, I shout, way, way too loudly, and it seems every eyeball in the room is on me. Everything okay over there? Says the bartender. Everything is just fine, my good man. I'd be obliged if you could rustle me up a pen and sheet of paper. Sure thing. He takes a pen from a jar and turns a paper menu over to the blank side and hands it to me. He smiles warmly at me and extends his hand. I shake it for a while. Probably too long. I'm just not used to this damn morphine. Say, any chance of me getting your autograph, Mr. Macfarlane? It doesn't matter how cynical I think I am. I am always delighted to find out that things in this life still have the capacity to surprise me. I hunch over the hard oak table and write the final chapter.
Chapter 44, The Final Chapter. There is the way things are, and then the way things appear. And it is the way things appear, even when false, that is often the truest. If I am remembered, it will always be by the 4 years I spent at Saturday Night Live, and maybe even more than that, by the events surrounding my departure from that show. As long as SNL exists, then so do I. When people come to see me do stand-up, it is because somewhere in their memory I live on SNL, dressed as a young Burt Reynolds, insisting Alex Trebek refer to me as Turd Ferguson. And they come to see me, and I am old and fat, and I don't mention SNL, and I do my answering machine joke, and they are happily disappointed. After the show, they stand beside me and take pictures, the way you would with a donkey at the side of a road. They tell me they're big fans, and they don't care what their girlfriends say. They understand me, even though they know good and well that nobody else does. I'm dry, they say. The next time I come to their town, they don't show up. It can be difficult to define yourself by something that happened so long ago and is gone forever. It's like a fellow at the end of the bar telling no one in particular about the silver medal he won in high school track, the one he still wears around his neck. The only thing an old man can tell a young man is that it goes fast. Real fast. And if you're not careful, it's too late. Of course, the young man will never understand this truth. But looking back now, I can see that my life since SNL has been a full sprint, trying with all my might to outrun the wolves of irrelevancy, snapping at my heels. It has all been in vain, of course. They caught and devoured me years ago. But not completely. Lorne would see to that. My foot would still make a vague imprint. Myself would still cast a faint shadow. And years later, I would write a book, and not only write it, but be in it as well. I think a lot of people feel sorry for you if you were on SNL and emerged from the show anything less than a superstar, They assume you must be bitter. But it is impossible for me to be bitter. I've been lucky. If I had to sum up my whole life, I guess those are the words I would choose, all right. When I was a boy, I was sure I'd never make it past Moose Creek, Ontario, Canada. But I've been all over this world, except for Europe, Asia, Australia, Africa, and South America. Oh, and Antarctica. But that's really splitting hairs. I mean, how many people have been to Antarctica? I never expected to be any more than a common laborer, and I would have considered myself lucky to have achieved that. But I was blessed with so much more. I'm a stand-up comedian, and have been for over a quarter of a century. I've performed thousands of hours, from a small club in Ottawa, Ontario, all the way to a small club in Edmonton, Alberta. Sometimes I get big laughs and think I'm the best stand-up in the whole world, and other times I bomb, and I think I'm not even in the top five. Before I was famous, I had a whole bunch of jobs where all I needed was boots. People would look right past me, or if they did look at me, it was with a mean look. But when I got famous, people would look at me and smile and wonder where they knew me from. If they flat out recognized me, they'd laugh and dance like they'd won a prize, and I'd just stand there and smile and feel warmth from their love. So the fame made the world, which is a real cold place, a little less cold. And as for my gambling, it's true, I lost it all a few times. But that's because I always took the long shot. And it never came in. But I still have some time before I cross that river. And if you're at the table and you're rolling them bones and there's no money in playing it safe, you have to take all your chips and put them on double six and watch as every eye goes to you and then to those red dice, doing their wild dance and freezing time before finding the cruel green felt. I've been lucky. Chapter 45, Me, Myself, and I. I never should have trusted Adam Egitt to keep an eye on Keene. Now my secretary is gone, and I have to find him and find him fast. I have no idea how long he's been gone or where he is. We were finally starting to get some good work done. I thought we'd found a way to finish the book and pay off my debts, with me telling all my great stories one after another and Keene typing them down. I even let him throw in a few of his own lines from time to time to make him feel like he could become a writer himself one day. I talked to Julie just yesterday, and she told me that we were only about 1,000 words short of a book. At the rate Keene was typing, we would have been finished in a few days. We were so close. But now Keene is gone, and I am lost on the streets of Manhattan, knowing that if one of the goons from the Cadillac finds me, there's precious little this bat will do. I wander the streets for a long time, and pass the Regency House, where I once lived and was happy. But it has been destroyed and replaced with a 4-story art gallery. Everything above that is sky. I try to locate the 35th floor and the apartment that was my home, but it's just sky now, and I don't have the imagination. I forgot to change these clothes. Everything I wear says exactly who I am. So now I walk down the street with a huge target on my back, looking for the old fool.
I feel a little cold now, so I hasten my step, knowing I'm only a block away from a crackling fireplace and a warming shot of morphine. I'm sure Mr. McDonald will feel quite generous once I pull the McSorley's menu from the pocket of my SNL jacket. He will be confused when I first present it, but then I will announce it is the end of the book and the start of the money, and the party will begin and the morphine will flow free, and I will take just a little too much, and they will all think it was a tragic accident until they find this note. The future makes me so happy.
At first, I think I'm looking at a mirror that's right in the middle of the street. But no, it's just Keene, doing his best impression of me. I walk straight toward him. It is very important I keep him from making a scene.
Oh, God, it's him. I can see he has violence on his tiny mind. In his hand is the Garrig bat. My most prized possession, the Garrig bat. The lout has stolen it, and now he clearly means to use it to strike me. I don't care much about myself anymore, but I'll be damned if he destroys that historic bat with my skull. I fumble in my pocket for the pistol, pull it out, and aim the best I can.
I see the gun and freeze my step. His grip is weak, but he aims right at me. I try to speak reason to him, but I can tell he can't hear. I'm out of time now, and can only hope he misses. Once again, luck is my only out. I see the gun shaking and his eyes close tight, and there is nothing but that peculiar sound of a gunshot. And then I watch as my secretary's borrowed shirt turns red and he falls forward on the hard New York sidewalk. Behind him, I see the fat man with the artificial hair get into the back of the red Cadillac before it slowly drives away.
I open my eyes to see Mr. McDonald running full speed away, and I am on the ground and can't get up. My breath is too shallow for me to shout or even make a small noise, so I reach inside my pocket for the McSorley's menu and my pen, as I understand this will be the last of my writing. But as soon as I have a hold of it, my hand fails me, and the crumpled menu takes off running down the street. I smile, thinking that Mr. McDonald will have to finish the story of his life all by himself. Like all of us, I suppose. And then I smell the pizza. I know it comes from Ricardo's, across the street from my home, but it has never smelled this powerful or this good before. All I want in the world is a slice of Ricardo's pizza. The crust well done, with mushrooms swimming in red sauce, and nothing else. I am filled with remorse at what I have done. I try to get up again, to follow the scent of the pizza, but I slip and fall backward, and my head hits the hard pavement. I use my final breaths to take in the mushroom, and the red sauce, and the garlic. Life is so good.
The last part of the whole book. Well, this is the last part of the whole book. My secretary went and got himself killed. I got so mad at Adam Egan because he was supposed to be guarding him, but was sleeping instead, so I find a bat and start hitting him with it, and he gets down on his hands and knees to protect himself, and that's when he finds it. Norm, this is your memoir. I found it. I found it. And I'm happy, so I say, read it, to be sure. And Adam Egan opens it, and that's when there's a knock at the door. And me and Adam Egan get quiet and scared, because we know it's those goons that work for the fat man with the artificial hair. I take my bat and go to the door and open it, and the goon has some sort of costume on and is holding a little piece of paper and singing. So I hit him with the bat, and he falls in a crumple, out cold. And I take the piece of paper, and it looks like a telegram, and the words on it rhyme. And it's about somebody called Terence Keane and a book he wrote called The House Painter and how some book company wants to buy it, but the whole thing rhymes, remember? So I sing it to Adam Egan, and he tells me that Terence Keane was the name of my secretary and that my secretary must have called my book The House Painter and tried to sell it on the side. And then he says, look out the window, Norm, look out the window. So I look out the window, and there's a big blue truck with the words Western Union on it, and it is sitting in the same place that the red Cadillac used to sit. He's gone! Yes, Adam Egan, we got very lucky this day, I say, and then we run away to the alley and get in the Challenger, and then we drive away. Adam Egan says he doesn't want to read the book because reading makes him sleepy. And I tell him not to worry, nobody needs to read the fucking thing. just to count the words, because a book has to be so many words, and this one has to be 75,000 words, and that's how many words a man's life has to add up to. But then I think that every man is different, and that a nobody like Adam Egan's life probably adds up to 100 words or something. But a big shot like me, my life probably adds up to over 1,000,000 words, or even 1,000,000,000 words. So I take the tape recorder and start talking into it fast, and Adam Egan is counting words. And I just keep speaking words into the tape recorder, because the faster I read, the more words go into my book. And each word is a part of my life, even if the words don't make any sense. Because they don't have to, because that's not in the contract. Nobody ever said your life had to make a damn bit of sense, just as long as it had enough words, that's all. We stop at a bar, and Adam Egan says, "Will you take a look at her ass?" So I look at the waitress's ass, and he says, "Tell me that's not going into the book." And I say, "No, it's not." And he says, "You're telling me that you're not putting that waitress's ass into the book?" And I tell him, "No." And he says, "I'm crazy if I don't put her ass in the book." And I tell him he's so stupid, he doesn't even know what should be in a book. I tell him it has to be real important stuff, especially in the end part of a book. And besides, no book in the whole world is supposed to be about a waitress's ass. And Adam Egan starts pouting and says, "What's so special about you that you're better than a waitress's ass?" And I say, "I'm famous, that's what." And he says, "What's that ever got you?" So I look at the stupid idiot, and I say, "I'll show you what it's got me. I'll show you right now." And I yell, "Hey, waiter, get over here, because I'm hungry." And he comes over, and I ask him what the special is. And I'm lucky, because it's chili. And not that stupid fucking turkey chili that I hate either, but real chili with pieces of beef in it. So I say, to stall for time, And then my finger starts pointing at my name on my SNL jacket, and some time passes before the waiter says, "Hey, aren't you famous?" And I say, "Sure I am." And he says, "You can have the chili for free." And I say, "I want a whole bowl, and not a cup. Plenty of crackers, too." And the waiter agrees to the whole thing. I'm pretty pleased with myself, and I look over at Adam Egan, but he isn't sitting beside me anymore, because he is at the other side of the bar standing in front of a TV. So I go over to him, and he is talking like a robot. And he says the Toronto Blue Jays will win their baseball match tonight by 2 scores, and I can't believe what I'm hearing. So I hit Adam Egan hard on the side of his head. He falls in a crumple out cold. People come around to see what the trouble is, and I tell them I'm a really famous guy, and if they don't believe me, they can all just read my clothes. And I tell them Adam Egan is a nobody whose life is worth like 100 words. Everyone is cool with that, and it makes me think that that's another thing that fame gets you. You can just go ahead and hit a guy hard on the side of his head. I go back to my table and wait for my food and look around the bar to see where the waitress's ass went. And then finally, the waiter comes back, and he says he is sorry, but they are just out of chili, but that if I want, I can have a bowl of turkey chili. Can you believe it? Turkey fucking chili. Story of my life. We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of Based on a True Story, a memoir. This program was directed by Aaron Spencer. Producer, Dan Zitt. Text copyright 2016 by Norm MacDonald. Production copyright 2016, Penguin Random House, LLC. All rights reserved.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.